Welcome to Current State. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of MERS News, filling in today for Mark Bayshore. Well, it's primary election day in Michigan, with polling places around the state open until 8 p.m. We're going to open the show today with a look at how Michigan has weighed in on presidential nominees in the past. It hasn't always been done the way it's being done today, with primary elections for the Republican and Democratic parties. There have been open primaries and caucuses here in days gone by, too, and joining us to look back at presidential nominee selections in Michigan over the years is Bill Ballinger of the Ballinger Report. Welcome to Current State, Bill.
Glad to be with you, Kyle.
So if you go to the polls today, and maybe you already have, you will get to select either Republican or Democratic ballot, and you will select the nominee of your choice today. But it hasn't always been done that way, has it, Bill?
No. We vacillated between our traditional, what we call open primaries, the same kind of primaries we have in August for state races, where you can go into the polling place and go into the privacy of the booth. You can vote in either party's primary, and that's it. I mean, you make your choice from among candidates for one particular party. In these presidential primaries, there's been vacillation back and forth between doing it that way, which is really the way the Republicans have done it most of the time, and really caucuses, private party-sanctioned and run caucuses, principally by the Democrats, who have been fearful that if they open up their nomination process in a presidential race to voters of any sort, people who walk in Michigan and can choose to vote in their primary, even though they may not really be Democrats, they could be independents or Republicans, that some embarrassing result is going to happen. And in fact, it has happened to the Democrats at least twice in the past, principally in 1972, and they're very leery of that happening again. So this year, for the first time in many, many years, the Democrats have actually really given up their private caucuses, and they have decided, okay, we're going to elect our delegates to the national convention the old-fashioned way, the way the Republicans have been doing it, and we're both going to have each party, Democrats and Republicans, their primaries on the same day, today.
And maybe the difference here is that the Republicans have a competitive primary as well. The Democrats have a competitive primary as well. You mentioned the 1972 race, and I believe you're talking about Wallace getting the nomination for Democrats. Is that right?
Correct.
And that was an embarrassment because obviously he was not the selection for maybe the mainstream Democrats at that time. Is it because the Republicans went in and fiddled around in their primary that they had Wallace as the nominee coming out of Michigan?
There's been a lot of debate about that. Obviously, the Democrats suspect that that's exactly what happened, that there were a lot of Republicans who did raid the Democratic primary and produce the result of Wallace winning the nomination. By the way, let's turn that around. Back in the year 2000, there is no question, based on documentation, that Democrats raided the Republican primary and produced John McCain as the winner in 2000 in Michigan. Independents and Democrats, a substantial number of them, maybe 25% of the electorate, raided the Republican primary and racked up huge margins for John McCain on the Republican side. If only Republicans or people identified as Republicans had voted in that 2000 presidential Republican primary, George W. Bush would have won it. But it was Democrat presence in the Republican primary that produced John McCain as a winner, just as Republicans and independents back in 72 raiding the Democratic primary produced George Wallace as a winner.
Now, I'm going to go to 2004 because I believe that's the last time that the Democrats had one of these caucus systems that actually mattered. And the end outcome was that John Kerry won the state of Michigan. But explain to our listeners why it's very cumbersome and why Democrats and Republicans in general don't like to do a caucus.
Well, I don't know if it's cumbersome, but the fact is that Democrats hold it on kind of an odd day. As I remember, it was like a Saturday,
yep.
And they're in private schools. They're not in your traditional polling places much of the time. The Democrats in other words, we're trying to screen or control the types of people that came in and voted in this caucus for, you know, Democratic candidates running for president. They didn't want Republicans and independents coming in. So the turnout in these things was, you know, miserably low. But, you know, if you're the party organization, you're happy about that because you know the people turning out are real bona fide Democrats, and they're going to produce somebody the Democrats want nominated, not that somebody who's not a Democrat thinks ought to be the nominee, or maybe somebody from the outside who wants to muck up your primary and produce an embarrassing nominee that you as Democrats are then stuck with in headlines for days after that, announcing that somebody undesirable by most Democrats has won your primary or your caucus.
And let's take our listeners back to 2004. George W. Bush was going to be the Republican nominee. So if this were to go to the popular ballot, there would be no reason for Republicans not to participate in the Democratic primary.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, you're making a really good point. You know, if one party has a lot of skin in the game, they have a contest among a number of candidates, obviously people want to go where the action is. And if the other party really has no contest, let's say an incumbent president is running for re-election like Barack Obama in 2012 or whatever, there's not really any motive for Democrats, let's say, if it was 2012 or Republicans in 2004, to get out and vote in their own primary or in their own caucus. They want to get over in the other caucus or primary and mess things up and get their 2 cents in.
And let's talk about the timing of the primary today. And we're not going to get into the primary, talk about the candidates. But what we are going to talk about is how the situation is a little different from 2008, because in 2008, both sides had competitive primaries, but Barack Obama decided not to be on the ballot in Michigan. Remember that Hillary Clinton was on, and she was battling uncommitted. And the reason is because the Democrats and the Republicans decided to buck party rules and decided to have an early presidential primary in 2008. And the end result was that the Democratic Party said, you know what, at the national level, they said, you know what, we're not going to recognize this or participate in this. And so it kind of turned into a bit of a sham primary, Bill.
Yeah, oh, it was a sham primary. Barack Obama was not on the ballot. And so Hillary Clinton easily won the Democratic primary, virtually unopposed. You know, you point out another thing, and that is state law compared to party rules. When you get right down to it, no state, and Michigan is an example, can dictate to a political party how they're going to select their delegates to their national convention. They can pass a law, which Michigan had in place, as you point out, in 2008, saying, okay, here's our presidential primary day. But if the Democrats, who, by the way, weren't, you know, controlling state government to that extent at that time, don't like the way the game is being played as set up by Republicans, who are their opponents, they can pick up their marbles and go walk away, or individual candidates can. Barack Obama can say in 2008, I smell a rat, I don't like this situation, I'm not going to compete. And so, in other words, a primary law is only as good as the party and its candidates want it to be.
That's exactly right. And so this year, both parties are playing by Democratic and Republican Party rules. And so they will get their full slate of delegates, regardless of how the turnout is today.
Right. And one other thing, and you know this very well, there was big pressure, particularly on the Republican side back in 2008, 2012, to move up its primary on the calendar early in the year. You remember, we had primaries like in mid-January, if you can believe it. I mean, almost 2 months ago at this time, our primary would have been held already, over with. And that was in violation of national party rules. And the national party was saying to the Republicans, you do this and we're not going to seat your delegates. And the Republicans decided, you know, that's a risk worth taking because we're going to get so much more favorable publicity because we're going to be all alone early in the calendar right after Iowa and New Hampshire. The nation's eyes are going to be focused on us. And when you get right down to it, by the time we get to the convention next summer, nobody's really going to penalize us. Everybody's going to want to be happy and bury the hatchet, and et cetera. So the Republicans got the law changed to have this early and illegal primary, which, you know, was a completely different factor from what we find right now. This year, finally, both parties are in compliance with their national party rules as to the calendar. Both parties are in compliance as to whether it's in each one's best interest to have a primary today with multiple candidates on each side. And we're finally getting a good old-fashioned, legitimate, bipartisan primary, Kyle. It's been a long time.
Well, it has been. And, you know, you point out that in the past, the Republicans took the attitude, well, of course they're going to seat our delegates. They're not going to let us.
Right.
You know, but in 2012, they did penalize Michigan. We got a bum hotel way away from the convention site. And then they did have some real trouble seating people. And if you're a Republican stalwart, you know, going to the convention is like the going to the Super Bowl. I mean, this is a huge deal. And then you get your floor pass yanked. I mean, that's a big deal. And so then they decide, okay, they mean business. I guess we're going to have to go ahead and abide by the rules.
Absolutely. I think they finally got the message. You know, this national committee, they do have a little clout. They can really make us suffer. and we've been sticking it to them too long. And maybe we better back off and just abide by the rules.
So this presidential primary has been very competitive on the Republican side, and you've seen a lot of votes split up. I've heard it compared to the 1988 presidential primary, and I wasn't dialed into politics really at that time. I was wondering if you could share with our listeners if you see a similarity between this one and what happened in 1988.
Well, 88, boy, that was really something. I think most of what happened here in Michigan that year was really well in advance of what happened in Michigan, because the Jack Kemp forces and the Pat Robertson, remember him, forces,
yep. Mm-hmm.
Were running, and they won a bunch of kind of caucuses and county conventions and district conventions leading up to the primary that made it look like George H.W. Bush, who was then running for the Republican nomination as vice president under Ronald Reagan. He was running for the presidential nomination. He was the big favorite. Looked like it was going to be embarrassing, and he was going to lose Michigan. Finally, the Republicans got things turned around so that Bush ended up doing all right. On the Democratic side, that was another surprise result. If you're African-American in Michigan, you applaud this. But Jesse Jackson won the Democratic primary in Michigan in 1988. And that was the year that Michael Dukakis, at that point, had pretty much gotten the Democratic nomination all wrapped up. And so that was a shocking and surprise result. And the Democrats were a little concerned and angry and nervous that maybe, you know, people had gotten into their primary and meddled, like Republicans and independents, as we've been discussing. So, you know, that led to renewed angst about how you hold a caucus or a primary in subsequent years, in 92 and 96, and then we go up to 2000. And it's just been a constant battle back and forth as to which party conducts its presidential nominating process in Michigan, in which way, whether they abide by a primary, at what time in the calendar, or whether they go to a caucus, what are the ground rules, and it's been all over the map for all this time until this year.
You're listening to Current State. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in today. Bill Ballinger from the Ballinger Report is our guest. Bill, we've only got a couple minutes left here, but it kind of sounds like a theme we've been talking about for the last 15 minutes here, is that Michigan will go its own way. It will buck the system. It will pick people that maybe the rest of the country doesn't expect. We talked about John McCain. We talked about George Wallace. So Michigan has historically been a little bit of a wild card, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is. There was another big upset, and that was back in 1980, believe it or not. Ronald Reagan had the Republican nomination pretty well wrapped up. We had our primary that year, Kyle, if you can believe this, on May 20th.
Wow.
That is how late it was in the calendar, and that's the way it used to be for years and years and years. It was that late before we got up to, you know, like January, February, March. And George H.W. Bush was running for president, and he came into Michigan and was endorsed by the Republican governor, Bill Milliken, who took him all around the state barnstorming together. And by gosh, if he didn't beat Ronald Reagan on May 20th. I mean, people were stunned and shocked, but it was so late in the process, and Reagan had so many delegates in tow at that point that within a couple of weeks, Bush dropped out of the race. So it really became academic. But again, it was a shocking upset, and it plays right into your contention, and it's a good one, that Michigan produces surprise results on both sides of the ballot.
And I think it also shows that campaigning here in Michigan and actually putting forth an effort can yield some good results for people. And again, we're just going to remind people that today is the presidential primary day, and the polls close at 8 p.m. So if you want to get out and vote, you have to select either a Republican or a Democratic ballot. You cannot pick in both primaries. You have to pick one, and that is to the benefit of the respective parties, because they like to know who's playing in which primary. Bill Ballinger from the Ballinger Report has been joining us today. Bill, thanks for joining us on Current State. We appreciate it.
Kyle, the pleasure was mine.
You're listening to Current State. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in for Mark Bayshore. We'll be back. Now, environmentalists are raising alarms about a permit that could allow crude oil through a pair of 98-year-old pipelines below the St. Clair River. The company that owns those pipelines says they don't have any plans to do so, but activists say it could set a dangerous precedent. We talked to attorney Liz Kirkwood from the advocacy group For Love of Water. Well, if you remember from those high school English days, the sonnet is one of the many forms that a poem can take. And the sonnet dates back quite a while, about 800 years ago, in fact. Well, the Grand Rapids-based literacy nonprofit Writers Center, called the Great Lakes Commonwealth of Letters, or GLCL, is sponsoring a competition open to all aspiring poets based on this historic format. Current State's fine arts reporter Jamie Paisley spoke with organizer of the GLCL sonnet competition, a young poet named ZG.
The competition is rather spread across Michigan. You know, the GLCL is based in Grand Rapids, and the judge is over at the U of M, Professor Keith Taylor, and it's being done also with the cooperation of the Kalamazoo Book Arts Center. How was that process of pulling, you know, those Michigander threads all together?
The process came about with just a general, really deep-seated interest in each of those other parties. So Keith Taylor, the judge of the sonnet contest, came to mind early on because he's been a strong supporter of the Commonwealth and has come around for a couple of events, and we love his work, and I know he's got some good things to say about the sonnet, and so we really appreciate his taste and curation. He's edited some anthologies before. He's got a strong eye in that field. And the Kalamazoo Book Arts Center, that came to mind. I spent a summer there working on the letter presses and hand-making paper, so I got to know the people in that facility and really appreciated the work they do, the resources they offer, the space. When we were putting together this contest, GLCL, we were putting together the sonnet contest, we thought, let's bring these partnerships together and offer kind of a wider spectrum of interest to the sonnet, you know, which is an old form, and it kind of goes through these waves of being reborn and then kind of left to the wayside, and, you know, newer poets not really coming into traditional forms, kind of a way to encourage that. And for us, as the Great Lakes Commonwealth of Letters, focusing on resources and people doing great things just, you know, within our state, in our region is really important.
In reading the different requirements for the entries, it must be original, unpublished, as well as follow the kind of Shakespearean model of the sonnet form. But you alluded to it just a moment ago that it's also trying to bring in contemporary views on that form, that kind of strict format. Is an initiative of yours or just something you're trying out?
Well, this is the first sonnet contest that we've hosted. We've had a series of other contests, not just in poetry, but across the genres. We've had microfiction, and that's partnering with a different magazine. In that case, it was Cheap Pop out of Ann Arbor, and they published the winning piece. We've partnered with Passages North, a literary magazine in Marquette, Michigan, up in the UP, and that was for a short story. And then we have done a poetry contest in the past as well. But yeah, so this is we host a contest or two a year, and the intention behind that is to encourage, promote, and celebrate works of writing in the Great Lakes region. And one of our ways to do that is to offer a sort of publication and recognition. And though we don't have our own publishing avenue as of yet, we like to partner with organizations that are already doing that great work to offer that outlet. The sonnet is a really remarkable form, and I think we have a tendency as writers, even without understanding what the form of the sonnet is, to write in that prescribed syntax and meter. It's really interesting. Looking at a poem that might just seem pre-verse, that isn't studied or isn't really got a consistent pattern, a lot of tendencies inborn in young writers actually follow a loose sonnet form. So it's really an interesting thing.
We're speaking with poet ZG from the Grand Rapids-based Great Lakes Commonwealth of Letters about the sonnet competition, which is still currently accepting entries. The rules of this competition say that the entries should adhere to the Shakespearean format of the sonnet, and the date of the winner will be announced on April 23rd, Shakespeare's own birth and death dates. But the deadline of the competition next week also has a famous Shakespearean connection, particularly for fans of Julius Caesar, the Ides of March.
So the deadline is March 15th, and then that gives a little bit more than a month for Keith Taylor to pool through all the sonnets and make a selection. The winning sonnet will be published as a broadside by the Kalamazoo Book Art Center, who is also creating an original illustration that coincides with the sonnet on the broadside.
Now, ZG, when it comes to sonnet writing from any time period, do you have your own kind of preferred model?
I think some of the best examples of that, of course, other than Shakespeare, a personal favorite would be Edna St. Vincent Millay. In sonnet 42, "What lips my lips have kissed, and where and why, I have forgotten. And what arms have lain under my head till morning. But the rain is full of ghosts tonight that tap and sigh upon the glass and listen for reply. And in my heart there stirs a quiet pain for unremembered lads that not again will turn to me at midnight with a cry. Thus in winter stands the lonely tree. Nor knows what birds have vanished one by one, yet knows its boughs more silent than before. I cannot say what loves have come and gone. I only know that summer sang in me a little while, that in me sings no more."
As you read it, there's the element of sonnet form of iambic pentameter, which sometimes is lost in the reading, but is regained in the verbalization of the poetry. Is that... If you were, and I'm not saying you are, but if you were Professor Keith Taylor and you're going to judge these, would you be reading some of these out loud just to get that in the air?
Oh, absolutely. Without question, yeah. Now, again, not speaking for Keith Taylor, but myself, the poem, and I think especially the sonnet, in order to get a fresh sonnet, a new take on an old form, reading out loud and getting a sense of that voice, right, that freshness, that magical tone, you know, the subject itself is different, even if the form is the same. How can we bring new life to an old vessel?
The Great Lakes Commonwealth of Letters 2016 Sonnet Competition is currently accepting entries, but the deadline to enter is next week, March 15th. More complete rules and entry requirements can be found online at the Great Lakes Community of Letters website, which is readwritelive.org. ZG, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Totally.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Coming up on Current State, this year's presidential primary has turned out to be a pretty interesting one, but the origin story of Michigan's state-level primaries could give the hoopla of 2016 a run for its money. We learn more about Michigan's first state primary from Maria Taylor, assistant editor of the Michigan History Magazine. That and more after the break. The Enbridge pipelines beneath the Straits of Mackinac have been in the crosshairs of environmental groups for years. Concerns about the pipelines in the wake of the 2011 Kalamazoo River spill prompted Governor Rick Snyder to create the Michigan Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. This summer, Attorney General Bill Schuette said that the pipelines' days were numbered, but some environmentalists are now worried about another pair of pipelines a little farther south. Two pipelines laid in 1918 currently run underneath the St. Clair River in southeast Michigan. The Texas-based company that owns them applied in 2012 for a permit that allows liquid hydrocarbons, including crude oil, to flow through the pipelines. The company says it has no intention of shipping crude oil through the pipelines, but environmentalists say they want more information. Joining us on the phone to talk about the concerns of environmentalists is Liz Kirkwood. She's an attorney with the advocacy group For Love of Water, or FLO. Liz, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, and thank you.
The company that owns these pipelines, Plains All American Pipelines, first applied for this permit in 2012, but this has only recently started getting pushback from the environmental community. Why is that?
Well, as I understand it, and the facts about this these particular pipelines are just unfolding now, is that this is really the first time that many that the public has really been aware that there are 98-year-old pipelines in the St. Clair River, and you know we've known there's obviously lots of transport of oil and gas, but when there's a transfer of ownership from one company to the next, this is what triggers the presidential permitting process. And the 30-day period came and went, and there really was very little public commenting, and that's really the concern.
So how many pipelines would be covered under this permit?
Well, there are six pipelines that Plains All American has purchased. Four of them are not at issue. There are only two that are issue in this modification of the presidential permit. And these are the 1918 pipelines that were approved under President Woodrow Wilson at the end of World War One.
So who is in charge of the decision to accept or deny the permit? You mentioned a presidential permit here. Does that go all the way to Barack Obama?
It actually is delegated to the Secretary of State, John Kerry, in the State Department.
Wow. And so what criteria does he use to determine whether he's going to accept this or not?
The presidential permit is decided, the State Department needs to, well, excuse me, if, you know, if a company is transferring an existing permit and it, you know, it's essentially unchanged from that previous permit, then the State Department processes the presidential permit without the level of, without NEPA analysis under the National Environmental Protection Act Environmental Review. And the only time that the environmental review process is triggered is if the permit transfer has, is a potentially significant impact on the quality of the human environment.
Okay. Plains All American Pipeline, that's the Texas company that owns the pipelines, says that all this permit really does is update ownership status after its purchase of the pipelines from Dome Petroleum in 2012 and doesn't change anything about the content of the permit. So if they're not changing anything, then why should there be new concerns about it?
Well, as we understand it, the original permit that was the original presidential permit that Plains applied for in 2012 did not include crude oil. It was just limited to those light liquid hydrocarbons, as you mentioned. And so this modification now is going to extend the authorization to the original contents back in 1918. As we understand it, these pipelines have not been active for many years, and they're 8-inch in diameter, and there was a five-inch diameter sleeve that was placed on top of it. And there are many, many questions about the integrity of these pipelines and the risk that crude oil poses versus light liquid hydrocarbons is very significant in terms of the emergency response.
So we really don't know much about the conditions of these pipes, do we?
Correct.
And so that creates some concerns. How about government oversight on this? The Department of Environmental Quality, for instance, is there any type of oversight that gives you some reassurance that they wouldn't do anything that would potentially spring a leak in the river?
Well, the jurisdiction is complicated because there's mostly a unified approach for the regulation of the safety and maintenance of these hazardous liquid pipelines and also natural gas pipelines. And under the Department of Transportation, the responsible agency is PHMSA, or the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration.
Liz? Well, please continue, Liz.
Yes. What is interesting, though, Kyle, is that the right now the U.S. EPA actually has there's a window still for interagency comments, and so the U.S. EPA can potentially submit additional comments and concerns about the transport and the expansion of the use of crude oil in these pipelines. And the date, as I understand it, is open until April 25th for the EPA and other agencies to comment. But this is at the federal level.
Liz Kirkwood is an environmental attorney and the executive director of the advocacy group FLO. We're talking about a permit request from Plains All American Pipeline. Now, we spoke with Plains yesterday, and they wrote to us that pipelines are one of the safest, most reliable, and most efficient means of transporting crude oil and natural gas liquids. Now, many people in the oil and gas industry point to pipelines as being safer than alternative methods of transport like rail or truck. What's your response to that?
That is absolutely true. But that is not the issue here. The issue is that the public would like to understand what the current status of these pipelines are in terms of, the specific product that is being transported, the integrity of the pipeline, what risks these pipelines pose to human health and the environment. These pipelines, as you know, Kyle, are 25 miles north of the Detroit water intake system at Belle Island. And imagine what the impact of an oil spill could be you know, south of, you know, south of these pipelines. Now, there are many unanswered questions in terms of the location. If these pipelines are buried underneath the bed of the St. Clair River, that would pose obviously less risk than if these pipelines are exposed. We don't have information about that at this moment. There are a number of signs in the area that say do not anchor. But this is kind of this chemical thoroughfare for many different pipelines. And so kind of unraveling and, you know, discerning which pipeline is which is the next task.
A lot of environmentalists point to the age of the pipelines as a cause for concern. But in a statement provided to us yesterday from Plains, they said that while the original pipelines were built in 1918, a smaller pipeline was put inside of those pipes in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
So the 98-year-old pipeline won't be the one holding whatever substance is being transported. Does that change your opinion at all?
It does not change my opinion in terms of evaluating the integrity of the pipeline. What's very interesting is that pipelines, it's difficult to just make general assertions about the integrity of a pipeline just based on age. But some of the materials are better than others. In fact, many of the I'm not a pipeline expert, so I won't get into that. But I should say that the most important issue is just evaluating the integrity of the pipeline and the materials to determine if there are any risks for a pipeline rupture. And that is the type of information that the public is interested in. So assurances are good, but what we really are interested is hard data to evaluate and make informed and smart decisions.
Have you been satisfied with how Republican legislators have acted in this? I know you've gotten support from Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters.
Well, yes, Representative Candace Miller. She and her colleague both authored a letter to the Secretary Kerry, also very concerned about this issue. Michiganders are interested in transparency. We want to know what is in our water, how we can lower that risk, and this process is really critical to it. And it's also Representative Candace Miller and Representative Debbie Dingell authored a joint letter on March 1st to Kerry.
Well, very good. Well, Liz Kirkwood is an environmental attorney and the executive director of the Clean Water Advocacy Group FLOW. We've been talking about the pushback from environmentalists about a permit for two pipelines below the St. Clair River in southeast Michigan. Liz, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. We've got primaries on the brain today with the presidential primary happening today, but you might not know that Michigan's primaries for state-level officials got off to a very interesting start back in the turn of the 20th century. The story involves the World Series, heated arguments, and senators being dragged to their chamber by Lansing police. It was told at length in the most recent issue of Michigan History Magazine in an article called A Matter of Primary Concern. The article was written by magazine's assistant editor, Maria Taylor, who joins us here in the studio now. Maria, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me. This is a fascinating and entertaining story, and we'd like to tell an abbreviated version for our listeners. So let's start by setting the scene. It's Michigan, early 1900s. How were officials like governor and lieutenant governor chosen back then?
Actually, nominations for governor and lieutenant governor didn't come until about 1905. Prior to the early 1900s, candidates for office, that includes local, state, and even national, were nominated by party bosses behind closed doors at caucuses and conventions. Regular people, ordinary voters, had very little to do with the process.
So in 1905, Fred Warner became governor of the state of Michigan, and he wanted to implement a primary election reform statewide. Why is that?
He thought that the caucus and convention system didn't accurately reflect the wishes of the Michigan people.
So he proposed a bill in 1905 that didn't take off, so he tried again in 1907, and this attempt led to a legendary fight that became known as Warner versus the Boxers. What were the main elements of this proposal?
There were several main things he wanted to get passed to improve the 1905 bill. One was having all Michigan primaries on the same day statewide. Another was getting rid of a clause that he called the 40% clause.
And explain what the 40% clause was.
In order to be nominated, a candidate for governor or lieutenant governor had to win 40% of the vote. If he didn't, then nomination reverted to the convention system as of old.
So it sounds like one of his main objectives was giving the people more power to elect the officials, right?
That was the point of the bill.
All right, so this new bill passed in the House, but when it got to the Senate, they debated it for 2 weeks, and the vote was split evenly. Who is to blame for this deadlock?
Surprisingly, it wasn't party politics. All 32 senators were Republicans, like Warner. But, while half of them supported the governor, the other half had formed this anti-administration faction called the Boxers.
Okay, and why were the Boxers so against this bill?
Well, they said that it was created only to help Warner get reelected. Truth be told, though, the Boxers would oppose just about anything the governor supported, regardless of whether or not it would help the people of Michigan.
I'm speaking with Maria Taylor, the assistant editor of Michigan History Magazine. She wrote an article in the latest edition about a very interesting history of Michigan's primary, and she's relaying that story now. So since the legislature couldn't come to an agreement, Governor Warner made them reconvene for a special session about 5 months later. When they reconvened, they still couldn't agree on anything bill-related, but they did agree on something. What was that?
Taking a few days off to make it down to Detroit in time for the World Series. The Tigers lost, but the senators didn't care. They had a great time. So did the media. They called the senators out for neglecting their duty.
But they were probably able to regroup a little bit, keep things into perspective. And they ended up coming to some kind of agreement. So what did they come up with?
The reformers lost on the 40% clause that stayed in, and primary elections remained optional, not mandatory. But the good news about the bill was that it was workable, as opposed to the status quo, which was not.
So we're getting to the best part of the story here. The agreement they finally arrived at did away with many of the things Warner wanted. So he issued a scathing criticism blaming the Boxers. When they heard the criticism, what did they do?
The Boxers grouped together to write a response. But while they were in their little session, the rest of the governor's supporters fled the Senate and fanned out across the city.
So what happened then?
When the Boxers finished their session and had their resolution all written, they emerged and they were furious because they did not have anyone to hear it, and they did not have enough senators for a quorum.
So Senator Thomas Allen was one of the ones that they captured. So the Boxers actually went around the city of Lansing, or
yes,
is it Detroit?
They called Lansing. They called out the Lansing police to bring them back. And as an extra precaution, they even locked the Senate doors so that nobody else could escape.
So could they do that? I mean, would they do call the police and everything and try and get them into session?
Yes.
Now, could they do that? Did they have the power to do that?
They did. They only had one sergeant at arms, and that wasn't enough to capture all 15 truants. So the Boxer leader, he was in a furious rage. He called out the Lansing police.
So who was the head of these Boxers?
His name was A.J. Tuttle.
A.J. Tuttle. Now, was there any kind of geographic similarity with these boxers? I mean, what kind of brought them together? Were they just a bunch of malcontents?
I'm not sure. They really opposed the governor, though.
Okay. So there was no, like, geographical similarity here, right? It wasn't like they were.
I don't think so.
They weren't. Okay. So anyway, so they decide that they're going to get the police together and they're going to call in everybody else. Now, did they have the power back then to do like a call of the Senate? That's what they do these days.
Yes, they did a call of the Senate, and the boxers insisted that the truants be brought back in handcuffed and in ball and chain if necessary.
So that was done. So what was this resolution that they came up with? What did it say that they wanted to pass so darn bad?
They wanted to give a rebuttal to the governor and say that he had basically tarnished their reputations politically, professionally, and personally.
So was this covered in all the local newspapers? I mean, what kind of attention did this get?
It was covered in two Lansing newspapers by two reporters, which they stayed for the whole session. They really couldn't help it because they were locked in.
They were locked into the building, too?
Yes.
So Senator Thomas Allen was one of the people that they captured. So where did they find this guy?
He was on the steps of the Grand Trunk train station. The police chief captured him and sent a message back to the Senate saying he was bringing him back handcuffed and hooked to ball and chain.
Ball and chain. They used the ball and chain back in 1907. This is great. So tell us about some of the others they found.
Well, they found four more at an opera house in Lansing.
Oh, was there actually a show going on?
I'm not sure. Okay. The reports didn't say.
All right. So was there anyone else that they were able to find?
Well, they found one who was managed to escape. He jumped a moving train. The opera goers managed to get away, too. They tweaked their fingers at the arresting officer, and I can only imagine that meant they flipped their fingers, and they walked off.
Oh, my goodness. Now, did anyone get dragged back to the chamber, like literally dragged?
The person who was in handcuffs somehow managed to outrun the police chief and escape. They did find one poor Detroit senator in his hotel room and dragged him out of his bed and made him come to the Senate to vote.
So how did this all resolve then in the end?
The boxers ended up presenting their protest speech to a grand total of two of the governor's supporters. It really didn't make any difference, though, because the bill had already been passed, and it went into effect with the new year, 1908. Governor Warner won a third-term victory and became the first Michigan governor to be elected under the primary system.
Wow, that is really interesting. So the resolution was just them spouting off, right?
Yes.
I mean, they didn't have any power at that point.
Nope, it was just a protest.
So why did it matter that much that they had to call out the police? And
they were pretty vocal in their opposition to the governor, and they just probably wanted to create a scene.
Goodness gracious. And so, but the bill that was passed, and they had some boxers supporting it, right?
Yes.
Was it? Okay.
It passed 28-2, the compromise bill.
Okay. So it was basically a compromise. And this was the first time then that voters actually got to participate in selecting who the Republican and Democrat nominee or just the Republican nominee for governor?
No, I'm not sure. It could be either one.
Okay. But then Fred Warner then went down in history as the person, as the governor, who created a system where the people actually had to participate in the Republican and Democratic primary.
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's very interesting. So why did you write this article? Why was it important to relay this story?
I volunteer at the Governor Warner Mansion, which is Fred Warner's home in Farmington. It's been created, or it's been turned into a museum. I'm the publicity coordinator there, and I write a monthly column called Mansion Musings for the local newspaper.
Oh, how interesting.
I was researching political topics for the March column, and I came across this, and the more I read about it, the more interesting I thought it was. And I thought people across the state might be interested in hearing about it, too, so I wrote it for Michigan History Magazine, where I work as assistant editor.
That's very interesting. Well, I've been speaking with assistant editor of the Michigan History Magazine, Maria Taylor, about her article, A Matter of Primary Concern. The article tells the story behind Michigan's very first primary, and you can read it in its entirety in the current edition of the magazine. Maria, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Don't forget to vote today.
Very good. You got until 8 p.m. to do that at your regular polling places, and again, you have to select either a Republican or Democratic ballot. You cannot participate in both. And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we'll break down the results of the Michigan presidential primaries with Jonathan Osteen of the Detroit News and Susan Demas of Inside Michigan Politics. Plus, Clint Black has sold 20 million albums and he's on tour to support his latest, On Purpose. Scott Pohl talks with the country music superstar as he heads to Battle Creek for a show on Friday. That and more Wednesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Also thanks to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in today for your connect with Current State on social media at KAR Current State, on Twitter and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.